cried. Fight me another way to die, she cried. She cried. Please find me another way to die, she cried. She cried. I don't know where to start. When everything falls apart, find me another way to die, she cried. She cried. Please find me another way to die, she cried. She cried.
As I was walking past and she was sitting down, she said to me, "Are you this fella?" "Yes." What a day. That love would shine
. Life is precious. Down we go. Growing old. Another way to live, she cried. She cried. She cried.
And now these people are staying. Welcome to Let's Talk, brought to you live by the National Indigenous Radio Service, the only opportunity offered to the broader community to be informed on the issues and current affairs from a First Nations perspective. This is Bo Spearham with Let's Talk.
Before we start, I would like to acknowledge the traditional owners on this land we are broadcasting from. I also would like to pay my respects to our elders and also our elders of more recent arrival. Thank you for tuning in to Let's Talk this morning. Also, a big shout out to everybody that is tuning in via the National Indigenous Radio Service, NIRS, taking us into the various different communities around our beautiful continent. On this morning, I have the CEO of the Healing Foundation, Richard Weston. Just before we start, Richard, could I get you to tell us your name, your mob, and where you're from, please?
Well, my name's Richard Weston. My mob are the Marian people, or the Murray Islanders from the Torres Strait. That's where my mum was born. But I was actually born on Gadigal country in New South Wales. I grew up in Western Australia. My family moved to WA when I was very young, so I grew up on Noongar country. And I've worked in a number of places across Australia, working in Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander affairs. I've been in the Pilbara in Western Australia. I've been out in Barkindji country in far west New South Wales. Spent 12 months as a CEO of the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Community Health Services in Brisbane at Woolloongabba.
Oh, yep, didn't you?
That was a fair while ago now, but I've been in Canberra working for the Healing Foundation, and this is Ngunnawal country we're on here.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been here for 9 years.
Spent quite a bit everywhere.
Bit of a travel, been all over, mate. Yeah.
Hmm. And the reason why we got you on the program this morning, and thanks for that, is because of the new report that has come out, the Healing Foundation commissioned,
yep,
discussing the issue of intergenerational, mm-hmm, trauma, but then also the effects that continues to have on a lot of our family members that are, yeah, part of the Stolen Generation. And just for our listeners as well, the Stolen Generation has affected countless of Aboriginal people, not just the family, the individuals. It has destroyed families all over this continent, but the conversation we're having is the effects that it has on our family members and the individuals are part of this Stolen Generation.
Yeah, that's right. I think that's right, though. This is, this is an important report because it's the first detailed demographic study of Australia's Stolen Generations and their descendants. And what we're defining as stolen generations in this report is people who were forcibly removed from their families prior to 1972.
Mm-hmm.
But we, of course, we know that, you know, children are still being removed from their families.
Mm-hmm.
But that this era that we're talking about was the period of the Protection Acts through the 20th century that were all over the country, including places like Queensland, WA, etc. And the policy was, essentially an assimilation policy that Aboriginal people would become white and made to be white. And to make that happen, they, authorities, through the power of the government, the government passed laws so that it was legal to do it. They went into families and communities and took children away.
Mm-hmm.
So children were isolated from their communities and their culture, their language. They were institutionalised. And within those institutions, they experienced a range of different types of abuse and neglect. So they were never shown love, and they weren't nurtured as children. They weren't provided with a proper education, and the expectation was that because they were Aboriginal kids, that they would, only ever be able to work in menial, labouring type work for the men and domestic service for the girls. And that was the environment. That was that era prior to 1972, and that's what this report's sort of focused on in terms, mm-hmm, of Stolen Generations, but it also talks about the descendants of Stolen Generations as well. So it's quite an important report because until now we didn't even know how many stolen generations were living across Australia, let alone where they were and how they lived.
Yeah. How do you take that approach to sort of find, I guess, round up this, the numbers? How do you round off that?
Well, the work that was done. This report was put together by the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare, and they used Australian Bureau of Statistics data, and this is data that's been collected for the last 16 years. The Australian Bureau of Statistics, or the ABS as we call them, they conduct some surveys that are specific to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. So they do a national social survey and a national Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health survey. So they go out and they ask a sample of the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander population, a whole bunch of questions, and they do that every 2 or 3 years. So that's where the information's come from. And the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare, who compiled the report, they do a lot of reporting for government. So they're kind of funded by government, but they're independent of government. So they provide the reports that go into the Close the Gap, the Prime Minister's report to Parliament every year. They do things like the Health Performance Framework. So they do a lot of report, and government uses that information to allocate resources. They use it to inform their policy making. So this report that we contracted the AIHW to do is based on the best practice and the best information available from our own government. So that's how it's come about. It's not necessarily brand new information. I mean, it's been sitting in these surveys for a number of years, but it's the first time it's been put together in this way to paint a picture of what life is like for stolen generations and their descendants. And, the report's showing, an alarming level of social and economic disadvantage there.
They're 1.5 times more likely to experience, to be arrested. Within 1.25 times more likely substance abuse to, obviously these substance abuse is a sort of used as a mechanism for lots of people, but as used as a way to sort of drown away traumatic experiences that
that's right,
our mob have faced in this instance, like you said earlier, and in this report saying 17,000 members of the stolen generation all across the country. Not to say that all of them do substance abuse or run in with the law and stuff, but this is something that's really alarming at a high rate for a minority within a minority.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's right. There's this group of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders within our broader Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander population that have greater risks to their health and their well-being. And as you say, people use, they will, they're at greater risk of using drug and alcohol to self-medicate and get in the pain and the hurts that they've experienced. And that's why, that's why this report's so important, because it just helps us understand that what trauma does to people. And that's the other thing about this piece of work, is that it helps us understand what happens when you forcibly remove tens of thousands of children from their families. So we create this situation where children have a really poor start in life, and that trauma that they experience through removal, through isolation, through institutionalisation and through the abuse in those institutions is long-lasting. It doesn't just go away by magic. It stays with people and it stays in their memories. People live lives that are, they're fearful of authority. They find it very hard to regulate their emotions, which leads them to getting into trouble with the law or into trouble with authorities. They carry a lot of pain and hurt, and that leads to risky health behaviours like using alcohol and drugs. And each time they take on these risky behaviours, then it just compounds their their trauma and their pain, and they get stuck in a cycle, potentially get stuck in a cycle. That's not to say that everybody does, as you said.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some people might be vulnerable for a number of years, but then they find a way out of it. I know I've met, you know, quite a few people from the stolen generations who've had challenges in their lives, but they've overcome them. You know, and they found a way out of trauma, or at least a way to live with it.
Yeah.
You know, those painful memories don't think ever go away, but at least people are able to you know, experience some healing and, you know, do something productive in their lives. But for many people, you know, there's, you know, it's been a long lifetime of pain and hurt. And,
yeah.
You know, and look, this report says there's 17,000 stolen generations living in Australia today, but it doesn't tell us how many people have passed away,
mm-hmm.
You know, without acknowledgement, without any healing, you know, without being believed that they were stolen children. So this report paints, you know, a difficult picture for us, but it's also a picture of sadness and hurt. And this is... you know, this is part of our history, part of Australia's history, and this is what happens when you remove children. And this report proves that link between that removal of children and the experience of intergenerational trauma. So those other issues, we can see them in this report: family violence,
mm-hmm.
suicide, mental health problems. It's all there.
Well, I guess, you know, like the report outlines all this stuff. Where to now then?
Yeah, well, that's a big question, isn't it? Look, the Human Foundation... is working on an action plan for healing, and this report, doing this piece of work, is part of that process. And you know, the Minister for Aboriginal Affairs and Indigenous Affairs, the federal minister, Minister Scullion, asked us to do this work, and he gave us some money to do it, and we're going to be reporting back to him in the next few months with an action plan for healing, for how we might start fixing these issues up. But and the sort of things, and just to give you an idea, that the sort of things we'll be calling for or recommending is that we need to scale up healing approaches. So we need to invest in healing for families and communities. And healing is a way to overcome trauma, and it's a proven way to start tackling trauma and overcoming it. And it also helps, like, it's a way to engage families and communities in their own recovery. And that's what I think is really, really good about it is this, we're only going to fix these problems if communities and families get involved and take ownership and start to drive their own, you know, lead their own healing. We just don't have, I don't think the country has the resources to provide the raft of services that we need. You know, we do have quite a good service system, but this report's telling us it's not enough. So we want to see scale up in healing, more trauma-informed capability in our services.
Mm-hmm.
The stolen generations have urgent needs around their aged care.
Mm.
So we need a focus on flexible aged care provisions for stolen generations, and we need a national reparation scheme for stolen generations, something that's going to provide equity across the country. We've had most of the stolen generations, 73% of them are in Queensland, New South Wales and Western Australia, but it's only New South Wales that's really had a comprehensive type of redress and reparation scheme. So we want national leadership, and this is what the stolen generations have told us that they want, is they want national leadership for a reparation scheme that everyone can, you know, everyone has equal access to, regardless of where they live, where they're removed from and where they're removed to.
Mm-hmm.
And we want a national approach to tackling intergenerational trauma.
Yep, and like that's one of the things that stuck out to me when I'm within the media release and also the report that stood out to me was the National Intergenerational Trauma Strategy as well.
Yeah, well, this report, you know, shows the link between, you know, what happens when you take children away and they experience lifelong trauma. I mean, it lasts a long time, but the thing is with trauma, it gets passed on from one family member to the next, from one generation to the next, and it just, and it, you know, get spread across the community. There's this ripple effect. And if we don't have a particular, you know, a focus on it, which we don't at the moment, you know, we talk a lot about trauma. It's starting to become more commonly used. But, you know, in this country, we don't understand enough about it.
Do you think, you know, the more that Australia recognises the trauma that our people carry, do you think that sort of becomes a shifting point in the discussion and also the understanding of how Australia was founded and also the continuing treatment of our people?
Look, I think for me, and, you know, my job is to... The job of the Healing Foundation is to eliminate trauma from our communities and support our communities to heal. That's our kind of our mission or our goal. So there's a debate going on at the moment about truth telling in our history, and I think that's really important. From my point of view, from the job I've got to do and the job our organisation's got to do, the reason we're interested in the truth is because it helps us find a solution today. So we're not really... I don't want to get involved in conversations that are about blaming or blaming white fellows or making them feel guilty about the past. I mean, that's not helpful to the job that I've got to do and my organisation's got to do. But what the truth is important for is to acknowledge that the problems that we have that are outlined in this report come from the past. They come from that past history. So it's happened. We can't change the past. We've got to accept that. But if we're going to accept that past, we've also got to accept the consequences that we're dealing with today. And, you know, you can't solve a problem unless you know what caused it or you acknowledge what caused it, because if you don't acknowledge what causes it, then you're going to have the wrong solution. And at the moment, we just, you know, a lot of our efforts are focused on individual different types of siloed approaches. So we have a focus on violence, we have a focus on drug and alcohol, focus on primary health care, and these siloed approaches. And they're still important. It's not to say that we wouldn't keep doing those things, but we need something to tie it all together. Mm-hmm. And I think that understanding the impact of intergenerational trauma and, you know, supporting communities, empowering communities, enabling communities, building capability there, to champion and lead healing, I think that could help, you know, take us a bit further down the path towards closing the gap, because at the moment we're just missing the mark somewhere, and I think this is something that's missing from the way we approach the development and design of services and programs.
And if you're tuning into Let's Talk here on 98.9 FM, my guest this morning is Richard Weston, the CEO of the Healing Foundation. We've been yelling about the new report that the Healing Foundation has commissioned in regards to intergenerational trauma for the stolen generation. One thing I want to ask you, Richard, when we come back and talk about is the links between PTSD and also intergenerational trauma that our mob experience.
So much to help you and to be there for you now, to help you from your hard times, if only I knew how. And though I know you had so much to go through life on your own, my hands and heart reach out to say you'll never. those for whom we can, to let them know this painful time is something we can share.
And you're tuning in to Let's Talk here on 98.9 FM. My guest is CEO of the Healing Foundation, Richard Weston. When we tend to talk about, you know, this word trauma, sometimes there isn't, it seems like there's not much enough weight to sort of carry the argument that, you know, this is passed down, or this is, or like there's acknowledgement of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people having, experiencing trauma that's being passed down. And we see around the world, or like we see in our society now, more commonly today, like return military services, service men and women having PTSD. You know, what's sort of the discussion around, you know, linking that these two things are that like these are the same things when we're talking about trauma is something that continues to play out in our communities?
Look, I think, I think the causes of those traumas are different. So our trauma comes from historical consequences, colonisation, right? Mm-hmm. People that experience trauma in war, well, that's the cause of their trauma. But the impact's pretty much the same. You know, people experience something that is terrifying or is very psychologically distressing. So that's where it starts. So people experience, an individual experiences a terrifying or horrifying event. And what that does to the person's body is it releases hormones that are there to help us survive. So we have these large amounts of adrenaline and cortisol. These are a couple of hormones in our, they're called the survival hormones, but they get pumped into our bodies and they help us survive. And that affects it. It kicks in at this part of our brain, which is called the survival brain. And that gets pumped, these hormones get pumped into our brain. So survival mode kicks in. And the three things we do when we're in survival mode, we'll either fight. So we'll fight our way out of the problem, or we'll run away because we're terrified, or we'll freeze. So there's three responses that our body and our mind does to help survive. And when you're in a life-threatening situation and you believe that you're going to either die or be very badly hurt, well, that sort of reaction helps you survive. But the problems for us have occurred because when that danger is removed, the person's body, the person's mind is still affected by those hormones, so that the body and the mind are still in survival mode even when there's no danger around. So that creates problems for us. It creates problems in the way we function. It creates problems in the way an individual will have in their relationships with their family members, other members of the community, or with authorities. People are often fearful. They're hypervigilant, so they're always on the lookout for danger. Often carry a lot of anger and are quick to anger, for really it's just the trauma playing out. And so there's a whole bunch of reactions, and these are physical and clinical reactions. These aren't just imaginary things that affect a person. This is not one of those situations where I could say, "Buddy, you've had a bad experience, just get over it." That's not going to work. You know, people need proper treatment. They need healing. Some people need some mental health services or some counselling. There's a whole range of different things people may need. But this is a very real issue. It's not an imaginary issue. So that's what happens for an individual. But in our case, for our stolen generations, it wasn't just individuals that this happened to. They weren't just, you know, one or two people here that were removed from their families and put into institutions. It was done to whole communities.
Mm.
So it was done. The trauma wasn't just, you know, just an impact on the individual. It was a collective trauma. So it impacted on the kids that were taken, but it was also impacted on the families, you know, the mums and dads that were left behind. So, you know, our trauma, this trauma is, it's deep. It's been long lasting. So it's gone on for generations. And, you know, unless we start to acknowledge and recognise and understand that better, then the problems we have today are just going to keep growing.
And definitely.
We know that. You know, the last 10 years, we've had 10 years ago, Australia signed up to the Universal Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People. And in that 10 years, we've seen almost a doubling of the number of children, for example, going into out-of-home care. And if we don't, you know, if we don't put a stop to that, if we don't break that cycle, then that number's going to treble, you know, it's going to triple over the next 10 years. So that's what trauma is doing in our communities. It's creating this vulnerability in our families and our communities, which makes it unsafe in some ways for children and women and others. And so unless we actually start to understand and recognise this trauma and start to implement and support communities to heal from it, then our problems are just going to keep compounding and getting worse and worse. And, you know, that the cost of trying to address those problems without the right sort of services or the right sort of information about trauma just keeps costing taxpayers a lot of money, and we're not getting the results we need.
Is there sort of frameworks or any other examples that we can sort of draw on internationally where governments, organisations have sort of, you know, done this research and done this work to sort of address intergenerational trauma with other Indigenous peoples, just other people around the world?
Look, there's examples emerging in, you know, Canada and New Zealand and places that have a similar colonial history. But in places like the United States, they've recognised that trauma is a problem. It's not just amongst Indigenous people. Mm. It's, you know, it's people that live in poverty. It's people that living in, you know, like they have communities in America that have very poor, that are dogged by violence and all sorts of social issues. So they're seeing this emergence of trauma, and they're recognising it as an issue. They call it, you know, sometimes they call it toxic stress, but they're starting to try and develop an understanding and strategies to tackle it. In the UK and, you know, some of the countries in the UK, like Scotland and Wales, are looking at a trauma-informed approach to their public policy, public health policies. So it's going on around in other parts of the world where this issue of trauma and intergenerational trauma is being recognised as a public health issue. But in Australia, we're a long way behind that from that. But, you know, there are examples where it's happening in other parts of the world that we can learn off. So that's important, and that's an advantage. But the other advantage Australia's got is we've got a group of living Australians, our stolen generations, and their descendants that we could be learning off. Mm. You know, we can talk to them, we can listen to their stories. I think if we start listening to these stories about the stolen generations and the, you know, from the people themselves, and we think of that with looking at that through a trauma lens and with a healing lens, then we start to see what that pain and hurt means. It's had an actual impact on a person's life and the way their lives have played out. So it's not just a situation, oh, you've had a bad experience or a disappointment, get over it. I mean, this is stuff that is, you know, people need help to recover from trauma. They can't just do it on their own all the time. And this report, the AIHW report, as you said, look, there's a lot of data, there's a lot of information in there. But I think the important thing then that we need to take away from that report is that the problem's probably a lot bigger than we thought. or that we knew. And if you've got a big problem like this, then you've got to come up with a big solution. So, you know, I think it has impacts. I think this report, once people start to absorb it and digest it, because there is a lot of stuff in it, I'm hoping that it'll start people rethinking what we're doing in our Indigenous affairs policies nationally. And in our services, that we have a lot of services, even if in our own Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander services, like our health services, education services, law services. I think there's scope there for us to improve our understanding of trauma, so that we can make our services more trauma-informed, but I think there's also the opportunity to understand better healing and find ways to support communities and families to start those healing journeys that are so desperately needed.
Definitely. And for our listeners as well, is a lot of this stuff we're yarning about accessible to them as well?
Look, this is a public report, if that's what you're talking about. People can access this report on our website, the Healing Foundation, which is healingfoundation.org.au, with the three W's in front, or the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare website as well. It's on there. And the Healing Foundation, we have other resources. We've just released a webinar. We ran a webinar a couple of weeks ago with some young people.
I've been busy here, yeah. It was deadly.
Trauma. Yeah, and Helen and Professor Helen Milroy was on there talking about trauma, and Helen's fantastic. And we've also released an animation that helps. That's trying to help people understand intergenerational trauma, how it does get passed down. And so there's some resources on our website. But you know, we're working hard on this action plan for healing that we want to present to the minister, and hopefully find a way forward where we can see more opportunities and access for people, communities, and families to access healing processes that are really important. And you know, all the healing work that we've done, we've supported around the place, around the country, you know, it's focused on culture and strong identity, and those things really make a difference to us. I think one of the messages from Professor Milroy is that, you know, the problem's big, the problem's difficult, but, you know, we can do something about it. You know, we all belong to the oldest living culture in the world. We've been around for thousands of years, and we had the answers. You know, we dealt with issues like trauma. We had our healers. You know, we have contemporary healers today, and so there's a lot of strength in our culture and in our people. Our survivors, our stolen generation survivors, they're not victims. They're strong people. They've been, if you listen to their stories,
survivors, and
a lot of the stuff that happened to them when they were children. So when we see them as adults, I think sometimes we forget that what actually happened to them when they were little kids. And for them to be, you know, surviving today and a lot of them thriving and doing well and actually having broken that cycle of trauma in their own families, you know, that's something we can learn on. That's something to be... that's inspirational to me. I find those stories very inspirational. So there's more positives and strengths in our culture and our people, and I think there's enough strength in our people and our culture to overcome this problem of trauma. You know, I think we can do it, but I think we need support from, you know, government and other service providers, including mainstream services, to help us, you know, work in a way that works better for us, with us in the lead and us helping to design those healing responses that we need.
And also for some of our listeners that are experiencing intergenerational trauma or their own trauma, you know, please do head to the Healing Foundation and look at some of the resources that they have. But also, you know, if you need to talk to somebody, give the Lifeline a call on 1-3-11-14 if in case you do need to seek out professional help as well. We do encourage that, and definitely encourage, you know, people finding their strength and well-being as well. I just want to say a big thanks as well, Richard, for joining us on the program this morning. Is there anything else that you would like to finish off on?
Look, Bo, I'd just like to... look, thanks for the opportunity. Thanks for giving that call and having a chat. I really appreciate that. I think this is important work that's been done by the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare. And, you know, it's something that the Minister asked for, so he's now got it. But we'll be, you know, trying to work with him about ways to take it forward and solve these problems. And as you say, if people are feeling distressed or... You know, we have resources. We have Aboriginal Health Services, and there's mental health workers there, and social emotional wellbeing workers, and our Stolen Gens and Link Up services. So make use of those services, and we'll go and see a GP or contact Lifeline. I think that's really important advice. And you know, I just want to acknowledge you know, our media organisations like yours, Bo, like our NAS Indigenous Radio Networks, just fantastic for getting you know, information and news out to our people in a way that we can access it. So keep up that good work, and look, always happy to talk to you guys anytime.
Definitely would love to get you back on. We've got the easy job here at the radio station. All we've got to do is actually mob the questions of the good hard questions. Work that is, you know, got to put together all this stuff. But big thank you for joining us on the program this morning. If you enjoyed the program this morning or would like to listen back, you can head to our website at 989fm.com.au and follow the links to the podcast, or you can listen tonight on 989FM. You can catch repeat at 7 p.m. You are listening to Let's Talk here on 989FM.
Tell me all his stories, show me all his tribal ways. See the paintings of his fathers, pictures of their dreamtime day. Hear the dingo howling mournful, or the dusty plain so white. The moon has turned the red to silver as the white ghost gum trees sigh. Black man, tell me all his stories, show me all his tribal ways. See the paintings of his fathers, pictures of their dreamtime day. Hear the curlew's call of sadness as the dancing country, land beneath the Southern Cross. Elders sitting round the campfire, in their native tongue they say,
the time.
When you get up in the morning, hear the work bell ring, and the march to the table, you see the same old thing. Ain't no food upon the table, ain't no fork up in the pan. But you better not complain, boy, you'll get in trouble with the man. Midnight special, shine a light on me. Let the midnight special shine a light on me. Well, if you're ever in Houston, I said you better do right. Well, you better not gamble, I say you better not fight, boy. The sheriff, he'll grab you, and the boys will be down. Well, the next thing you know, boy, you will be prison bound. Well, let the midnight special shine a light on me. Let the midnight special. Shout, shine its ever loving light on me. Would you tear my heart asunder just to fit Rhubarb's sweet song for you? Please hide this needless plunder, and I would sing my songs for you, and I will sing my songs for you. Amidst all this misery, there's a light that shines for you and me, and a story can be told of this love I won't grow old. Yes, this love I have. Rainbow in the city tonight, shining hooded, shining bright. Something special's going on this night, 'cause this feeling I've got is feeling right. Oh, this feeling I've got is feeling right. But my words won't sing on paper, and I can't show you my love much better with these songs I would sing for you. With these songs I would sing for you. Would you tear my heart asunder just a bit of a sweet song for you? Please hide this needless plunder. I will sing my songs for you, and I will sing my songs for you. Oh, can't you see that I cry for you? Don't you know? Don't you know I would die for you?
I've got a number on a napkin, a pounding in my head. It takes everything I've got to crawl out of bed. I lost a hell of a woman, freedom caught me on the chin, but I'm doing alright for the shape I'm in. The sun came up again this morning, I got a call from a long lost friend. Planned us a little road trip down to New Orleans. It ain't much, but it beats where I've been. Yeah, I'm doing all right. I'm doing all right. I'm doing all right for the the shape I'm in. Yeah. Well, I'm getting better at barely getting by. When I look at her picture, I don't break down and cry. And all this time on my hands is getting easier to spend. 'Cause I'm doing all right for the shape I'm in. The sun came up again this morning. I took my old fast back for a spin. Now when it rains, it ain't always pouring. And I'm learning how to live again. Yeah, I'm doing all right. I'm doing all right. I'm doing all right for the shape I'm.
With Dunn and Daly. With thanks to Seats R Us, Shady Characters and Century Trailers.
What's an app?
Joking kind.
joking kind. Yes, your love scares me to death, babe, 'cause it's the joking kind. Yes, your love scares me to death, babe, 'cause it's the joking kind.
The money can't buy.